The Wednesday after Robert returned to Cornell, Paul sent him some electronic mail. Any news on the Brilliant Project? 2 days later, Robert sent a message back. No news. I'm buried under legitimate work. Paul took that to mean schoolwork, but the virus project was still alive. One of the most time-consuming things Robert had done during his 4 days up at Harvard was to decode a collection of encrypted password files he had taken from various machines around the country. While directly decrypting a password may not be possible, guessing often works. It's impossible to decode a password by reversing the process that created the coded version. However, nothing prevents the decoder from guessing at the original password by coding, say, an entire dictionary in the same manner and matching the results against the coded password. Since many passwords are ordinary English words, a dictionary method yields a surprisingly high number of matches. The faster the computer, the more computers used, the less time it takes. On that Friday evening, Dawson Dean walked into the computer terminal room at Upson Hall, where Robert was seated at a Sun workstation. Dawson asked Robert what he was up to. When Robert showed Dawson what he had on his screen, Dawson's eyes widened. It was a long list of passwords in plain, unencrypted form. Robert scrolled down the list to reveal passwords of dozens of Cornell students and professors. Dexter Cozen, the graduate advisor, was on the list. His password? Tomato. Keshav Bengali, who was teaching the course in microprocessor design, he had chosen Snoopy. "Wow," Dawson exclaimed, "is my password on there?" His password didn't show up because it wasn't a dictionary word. "How about Aitken?" Bill Aitken was another graduate student who Dawson thought to be really obnoxious. Robert scrolled down and found Aitken's password. Subway. "Isn't it kind of dangerous to have a decrypted password list lying around on your account?" Dawson asked. The very tone of the conversation, Dawson's excited questions as if he were getting a vicarious kick out of the illicitness of what Robert was doing, and Robert's careful answers, implied that there were some real taboos being broken here. "Well," Robert replied, "you encrypt what you can. For the rest, you basically take your chances." Dawson's curiosity had gotten the better of him. "Could you do this all over the place and build a nationwide database of passwords?" Robert told Dawson that he had other ways of getting into machines without relying on dictionary encryption. Dawson pressed Robert to tell him about the other ways he had of breaking into machines. Robert hesitated, but Dawson wouldn't give up. Finally, Robert said that from reading Unix source code, he had discovered several bugs. One was the back door in the sendmail program. Another was a bug in Finger that would also allow him to run a program on another machine without logging in. Robert said he had known about the two bugs for a year and didn't think anyone else knew about them. Dawson Dean wanted to skip the bugs talk and hear more about specific computers Robert could get into. He asked about a specific private company. Robert shook his head. "You could get in there too," he said, "but you really want to stay with machines that are owned by universities. Universities are less strict about their security in general." Further, Robert said, it wasn't really a good idea to access machines across state lines. Dawson then asked about one machine at the MIT Media Lab, a center at MIT that was studying technology and communications. Within a few minutes, Robert had logged on to the computer. Dawson was amazed. "What's the account you're logged in as?" Robert typed a command that would tell him the account name he was using. The computer replied with, "Nobody." Dawson was impressed. Obviously, Robert had fooled the machine and was logged in illicitly. But Robert didn't tell Dawson Dean he had any plans to do anything with the bugs, and Dawson Dean didn't ask. In fact, aside from Paul, Robert hadn't told anyone of the program he had been planning all semester, and on which he had been working in earnest since just before the trip to Cambridge. By this time, in fact, Robert had been programming the virus on and off for a little more than 2 weeks. A week later, on November 2nd, Robert was dismayed to see a posting on the network. Keith Bostick, who worked on Berkeley Unix, had posted a fix to the flaw in FTP. Since it had been just the week before that Robert had told Andy about the bug, this couldn't be a coincidence. Robert immediately suspected that Andy had alerted someone at Berkeley about the FTP bug. He fired off a note to Andy asking him if he had leaked the secret. No reply. This meant that Robert could no longer use the FTP bug for his virus, but the flaws in sendmail and Finger remained. Robert spent that afternoon and early evening putting the final touches on the virus. He finished the work at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. An hour later, having logged on to a computer at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, he typed in a few commands to execute the program. He went to get some dinner. In the time it took Robert to put on his jacket after pressing return, the program began to spread. Within a few minutes, it was already fanning out over the network. Computers started affecting one another like toddlers in a daycare center. Any Vax or Sun machine linked to any other Vax or Sun was instantly vulnerable. While Robert was eating his dinner, dozens of copies of the virus were already swarming around inside machines, vying for computer time. Machines had begun to slow down and then crash. Robert had planned to go home after dinner, but he couldn't resist returning to Upson Hall to check on the program's progress. When he logged in, the computer wouldn't respond. Something seemed to be going wrong. The virus was replicating out of control.